Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
And on many obscure passages of Scripture. It tells us about social, moral, financial, and religious conditions which prevailed in Palestine, in southern Mesopotamia, in Egypt, and in many other places which had a bearing on divine revelation. Archaeology helps modern men to know that the people, places, and events recorded in the Bible were not the inventions of Bible writers. The people of Abraham's day were real, flesh and blood people, just like us. The cities of Palestine and Egypt and Assyria actually existed. Those cities carried on commerce. They were populated with men and women, just as cities are today. Archaeology has done much good by showing just how real and how true the Bible really is. Archaeology actually confirms the existence of men like Shishak, Pharaoh of Egypt, Omri, King of Israel, and many, many others. It has discovered monuments which mention certain men, cities, battles, and other incidents which are recorded in the Bible. Archaeology provides hard evidence that the Bible writers were honest and trustworthy historians. It shows the Bible writers did not exaggerate. They did not try to make Bible characters more honorable, more righteous than they really were. All of this and much more are available to all Christians today because of the diligence and hard work of a dedicated group of archaeologists. Personally, I am thankful to God for the outstanding contributions archaeology has made to our study of God's book. Today's lesson will dwell on the topic, Archaeology's Help in Bible Translation and Interpretation. For reasons which ought to be obvious to all my listeners, I shall not dwell on the work of translation. This is a highly technical topic, which most of us are not prepared by training to understand. Although I shall plan to make a few comments about translation when we come to an examination of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I shall make a few comments today, but not many. When monuments, documents, and other materials are discovered, they often have a direct bearing on our study of the Bible. They help us, in many cases, to interpret the Scriptures, and they also provide some help in translation. The translation of the Bible from the original languages, Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew, often presents many problems. In some cases, the manuscripts have been defaced. They were sometimes kept in damp places where they deteriorated pretty badly. Mice, rats, and other animals have chewed on some of the manuscripts. As all of you know, if you have thought about it seriously, words change their meaning from one generation to another. New words which come from other nations may also be added to the language in which the Bible was written. For example, in the book of Daniel, there are Greek words which were used primarily for musical instruments, and there are some Aramaic words. Sometimes the meanings of these words are fairly obscure and very difficult to interpret. The Greek of the New Testament is not the same as classical Greek. Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates did not speak the exact language of Jesus, of Paul, and of John. Jesus spoke Aramaic, and some, if not most, of his words had to be translated into Greek. There actually are a very few words from the Aramaic in the Greek New Testament. They have been translated into Greek. Fortunately, there are thousands and thousands of literary documents which have been found that shed light on the New Testament Greek, generally called Koine Greek. The word Koine means common. The language of Christ and of the apostles was that spoken by the common man on the streets of ancient cities. It was not scholarly Greek. There are a great number of excellent books which bring together much of the material on Koine Greek. These books give hundreds of examples regarding the use of New Testament Greek among the common people of Palestine. Two excellent books were written by Adolf Deisman, Light from the Ancient East, and then another book called The New Testament in the Light of Modern Research. George Milligan wrote a splendid little book entitled Here and There Among the Papyri. By far the most useful book of the kind I am discussing was written by James Hope Moulton and George Milligan. Their book, The Vocabulary of the Greek New Testament, is a reprint and is alphabetically arranged and very easy to use. I want to give you one example of how important these documents really are. Please listen carefully to Paul's instructions to the church at Thessalonica. Now we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw yourselves from every brother who walks disorderly among you, and not after the tradition which he received of us. 2 Thessalonians 3:6. Now a question for you. What is the meaning of the word disorderly? The Greek word is ataktos, and might be translated out of step or out of line. There is also a verb form of the same word. The adjective form is translated unruly. 1 Thessalonians 5:14. Ancient documents known as papyri have come down to us which shed considerable light on the meaning of the Greek. The word literally means idle, I-D-L-E, truant, or lazy. But even if you did not know the Greek background of the word, you would come to the same conclusion by reading 2 Thessalonians 3:11. Please listen carefully to Paul. For we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, ataktos, working not at all, but are busybodies. What does disorderly mean? It means working not at all. There are hundreds of other words, both in the Old Testament and in the New, which have been clarified by the discoveries of archaeologists and by other scholars. I am grateful for these men and their discoveries. Now let us turn to archaeology's influence on Old Testament interpretation. Archaeology provides the following help in our interpretation of the Old Testament. The kinds of rulers which prevailed in Bible times, social and cultural conditions which were widespread in ancient cities, documents and monuments which shed light on the status of languages which were used in various civilizations, and the customs and traditions among the people of Bible lands. Alan A. McRae's article, The Relation of Archaeology to the Bible, in the book Modern Science and the Bible, makes this appropriate comment on archaeology's usefulness in interpreting the Bible. Anything that enables the Christian to understand these words better and to have a clearer understanding of their background is of tremendous importance. Page 223. Genesis 16 records the story of Sarah's giving Hagar to Abraham as a kind of secondary wife. Sarah was not able to bear a child, but could claim a child born to Hagar as her own child. Hagar bore a son, Ishmael, to her adulterous relationship to Abraham. N.B. Hardeman, founder and president of Fried Hardeman University, accused Sarah of originating the Ladies' Aid Society. She was attempting to help God out of a very difficult situation. From the Code of Hammurabi, we learn that a Babylonian wife could give her husband her handmaid in order to bear children to the lawful wife. Abraham and Sarah were imitating the customs of the people among whom they lived. This does not make their action right in the sight of God, but it does help us to understand their behavior. Incidentally, Dr. William F. Albright, the Dean of American Archaeologists, identified Hammurabi with Amraphel, Genesis 14:9, the king of Shinar, or Babylon. Isaac and Rebekah were blessed with two sons, Jacob and Esau. The Bible records the tragedy of Esau selling his birthright. Genesis 25:27-34. Between 1925 and 1931, Professor Kaira and his colleagues at the American Schools of Oriental Research found 20,000 tablets at Nuzi, an ancient city on the Tigris River in Mesopotamia. Scholars found many parallels between the writings on the clay tablets and those which are found in the Old Testament. On one of the tablets, there is a story of a man who transferred his inheritance rights to his brother in exchange for 3 sheep. Esau sold his birthright for some food which he strongly desired. One of the great love stories in the Old Testament was between Jacob and Rachel. The Bible tells us that Jacob worked for 14 years for his beloved Rachel. Leah was thrown in for good measure. When Jacob and his family departed from the house of Laban, Rachel took some statutes, which Laban called my gods. Genesis 31:30. When Laban learned that the household gods were missing, he pursued Jacob's entourage until he caught it. Jacob assured his father-in-law that no one among his children, wives and servants, had taken Laban's gods. Jacob even said that anyone who had the gods would not be allowed to live. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. Genesis 31:32. Laban searched Leah's tent and entered the tent of Rachel to search it. Now Rachel had taken the images and put them in the camel's furniture, and sat upon them. And Laban searched all the tent, but found them not. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord, that I cannot rise up before you, for the custom of women is upon me." And he searched, but found not the images. Genesis 31:34-35. The Nuzi tablets give us some insight into Laban's concern for the family gods. The person owning the household gods would have been in a position of leadership in the family. He would be assured of the family's property at the death of the father. Jacob had already taken 2 of Laban's daughters, many of his cattle on the farm, and now had the family gods. Laban did not want Jacob to get his property upon his death. Merrill F. Unger's book, Archaeology and the Old Testament, quotes H.H. Rowley, an English scholar, as saying, "These narratives reflect the social conditions in the patriarchal age and in some parts of Mesopotamia from which the patriarchs are said to have come, many centuries before the present documents were composed, and this is striking." Page 123. Dr. Unger adds, "But the fact that the patriarchal narratives correctly reflect customs that would long since have become obsolete in the age when the critics contend these documents were first reduced to writing, that is, around the 9th and 8th centuries, is only striking under such an artificial theory of their composition." Page 223. The Old Testament seems to be extreme in warning the Israelites about the dangers of being carried into Assyria and into Babylon. Dr. Abraham Joshua Heschel says, "The prophets act as if the world is about to collapse." Reading from the actual records of Babylonian and Assyrian kings will help us to understand why Isaiah and Jeremiah were so deeply disturbed over the Israelites' reluctance to heed the words of the prophets. The following quotation comes from the annals of Ashurnasirpal II, king of Assyria from 883 to 859 B.C., and they tell us in the king's own words of the cruelty of many foreign rulers. "I took the city, and 800 of their fighting men I put to the sword, and cut off their heads. Multitudes I captured alive, and the rest of them I burned with fire, and carried off their heavy spoil. I formed a pillar of the living, and of heads over against his city, and 700 men I impaled on stakes over against their city gate. The city I destroyed, I devastated, and I turned it into a mound and a ruin heap. Their young men and their maidens I burned in the fire. When the Jews knew the brutality of the Assyrian kings and of the Babylonian kings, the warnings of the prophets could not be considered gloom and doom predictions. The prophets were simply telling the truth. The book of Daniel tells of the handwriting on the wall at a state banquet which Belshazzar arranged for many of the prominent people in Babylon. The prophet Daniel was the only one in Babylon who could give the proper interpretation of the handwriting. Belshazzar assured Daniel that he would make him third ruler in the kingdom if he would interpret the writing. Why did he not promise to make him second ruler instead of the third? The truth of the matter is, Belshazzar himself was not the first ruler. He was the second. His father, Nabonidus, was the king, but was living in Arabia. Belshazzar was the co-regent with his father. He could not promise Daniel the second place because that was his position. Archaeology has provided great help in areas such as this. But let us turn for just a few minutes to the New Testament. The Apostle Paul sometimes used boxing and racing metaphors in the discussion of the Christian life. Do you not know that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain. And every man who strive for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. So fight I, not as one that beats the air. But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway or a reject. 1 Corinthians 9:24-27. The Olympic Games were begun in Greece. The city of Corinth was and is a Greek city. In addition, the Isthmian Games were held every 2 years in the city of Corinth. Corinth was located on an isthmus, as you remember. Starting blocks for races have been discovered in excavations at Corinth. Paul was writing to people who had probably witnessed both the Olympic and the Isthmian Games, and who had an intense interest in sporting activities. The Greeks were strongly devoted to building up their physical bodies, as you probably remember from your study of ancient history. Knowing these facts about Corinthian sporting activities gives us greater insight into Paul's use of boxing and racing figures of speech. It enables us to enter Paul's mind, figuratively speaking, and understand more fully the great message he had for the church then and for the church today. Archaeology has done us a great favor by uncovering some facts about life in the city of Corinth. Among the truly great discoveries by the archaeologists are the papyri. For those who may not be familiar with what papyri are, let me say just a few words. The writing materials during the time of Christ and of the apostles were vellum, which is sheepskin, and papyri. The papyri were made from the papyrus reed, which grew along the Nile River. The papyri were pressed together and made into a rough kind of paper. Fortunately for Bible students in our day, there are thousands of these papyri available. Some of these papyri contain bills of lading, love letters, business letters, governmental declarations, and such like. In other words, they were the means of communication among the common people. Studying these papyri gives us some insight into the way words were used among the common people in the first century. The papyri are invaluable for serious students of the New Testament. Let me give you just two examples from the papyri. In the Galatian letter, Paul refers to the law of Moses as our schoolmaster. The schoolmaster brought us to Christ. But after that faith has come, we are no longer under the schoolmaster. Galatians 3:24-25. Preachers have long insisted that the schoolmaster was comparable to a school bus driver. The bus driver picks up the child at his home and delivers him to the teacher. The bus driver has no responsibility for teaching the child or helping to mold the child's moral or spiritual values. There is a serious problem with this interpretation. It simply will not stand up under careful scrutiny. The Oxyrhynchus Papyri gave this example of the word schoolmaster. I took care to send and ask about your health and learn what you are reading. He said it was the sixth book of Homer and testified at length regarding your pedagogue. So, my son, I urge both you and your pedagogue to take care that you go to a suitable teacher. This quotation is from George Milligan's book, Here and There Among the Papyri, page 97. The Greek word for schoolmaster is pedagogos, from which we get our English word pedagogue, and which means teacher. The law of Moses was not like a school bus driver. He was a teacher who prepared children for a more advanced teacher. The law of Moses was God's means of getting people ready to receive the gospel of Christ. Paul refers to the New Testament as faith and says, "But after that faith is come, we are no longer under a schoolmaster or tutor." Galatians 3:25. A second example relates to the word daily in what is commonly called the Lord's Prayer. Jesus taught his disciples to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." Matthew 6:11. The word daily was questioned by some scholars as if the word were not legitimate. Origen, one of the so-called church fathers, argued that the word did not exist in the Greek language. Adolf Deismann's book, The New Testament in the Light of Modern Research, tells of a papyrus which was a housekeeper's book. Among other things on the list were these words, ta epiousia. This papyrus shows conclusively that Jesus used a common word for daily. It also shows the meaning of the word. I have given you just two examples of the light which the papyri and other ancient documents have shed on our study of God's book. There are literally thousands of other examples which are very helpful. The encouraging part is that additional discoveries are being made every year. Let me say again how grateful I am that there are men who continually search Palestine and other Bible lands to learn as much about the Bible and the times in which it was written as they are able. They render a great service to all serious Bible students. May the number of such scholars increase. In the past few weeks, I have talked with you at length about the great advantages of studying archaeology. Let me summarize briefly what we have investigated in these lessons. First, biblical archaeology sheds light on some obscure portions of the Bible. Second, it specifically confirms many of the persons, places, and events of Bible history. The Bible is not full of myth, fable, and imagination. It deals extensively with actual people, places, and events. Third, archaeology is a tremendous help in translating and in interpreting the Scriptures. Fourth, it helps committed Christians respond to the many senseless attacks against God's book. For these reasons and others, it is profitable to know somewhat about the field of archaeology. I hope and pray that our lessons on archaeology will be helpful to you, that they will show you that Christians need not be afraid of any discoveries which tell us about the Bible and about Bible lands. Next week, I want to speak with you on the Book of Mormon and archaeology. You will see a considerable difference between the archaeological confirmation of the Bible and of the Book of Mormon. I invite you to keep listening. May God bless you.